Recording. Okay. So last time we finished up talking about interfacing with devices by talking about direct memory access. And the idea here is that the device controller can write directly to the device driver buffer. So this is the software in OS. And this is the hardware can write directly to that rather than having this extra step beforehand. And, you know, and same applies to reads. And to make this happen, the OS tells the device controller the physical address of that buffer. So the OS decides where that buffer is rather than being fixed inside the device controller and avoids copies from one buffer to the other. And if we're really clever, maybe we can avoid, you know, other copies like from the OS's buffer to the applications, but that's a little hard. And when we're doing this, so there's been some confusion that's understandable. So still use this magic memory idea to learn what the device is doing, like, was there data to read, to tell device the physical address, and so on. So we're still using this magic memory idea to talk to the device controller. We're just sending the data via the device controller, writing it where we want it, reading it from where we want it, rather than us using that same channel to send the data. But all the sort of metadata, the information about what to do, what happened, and so on, still works that way. So after we talked about direct memory access, we talked about how we talk to hard drives and SSDs, and we gave our brief preview that our interface was in sectors, so that these hard drives and solid-state disks demand that we write or read a particular whole sector, which was, 512 bytes or bigger, and our file system needs to work with that. And we gave one design for a file system, the FAT file system, and we had several decisions we needed to make. So one thing is we needed to figure out how we're dividing up the disk as far as our bookkeeping for the file system. And the decision we made in FAT is that we're going to divide it up into these clusters, which are going to be one or more sectors put together, and we keep information about each of these clusters. And our information about each of these clusters was this big array that we put somewhere near the beginning, so-called, of the disk. And that would store a linked list information, so next pointers for a linked list, and also information about free clusters. And this was an entry for every single cluster. We also need to worry about, well, I get file names, not a cluster number. How do I find a particular file given that? And we solved this by having directories, which were special files, and directories contained a list of directory entries. And those directory entries gave the info about the file, like the name and the size, and the location of the file. And we could use that to go from the names our user was supplying to actually a bunch of clusters on the disk. So before I move on, we're going to talk today more about how hard drives and SSDs work, but questions about things we covered last time. Okay, so first some logistical things. So A bunch of people think I should give an extension on the paging assignment, and I agree that if I had, better foresight, maybe I would have set the deadline for Friday instead of Wednesday. But there was already an extension, and I know a lot of students planned around starting the assignment with enough time to finish it by then, and I really don't like playing the game where you have to guess when the real due date for the assignment is to make good plans. And given that we have a late policy, which I encourage you to use if you haven't checked it, because 3 days is 90% credit, 5 is 80. And we have a little bit of a gap before the FAT assignment checkpoint is due. Hopefully that will mitigate this a bit. I know our office hours have been crowded, and we've been less efficient because of the new format. I generally don't take office hour crowdedness as a reason to change deadlines, because we have a general assumption that you should be able to complete the assignment without it. And if you do need the office hour help, like, you shouldn't be surprised that if you're like in a not just finishing up the assignment that you can't get the help you need in the last 24 hours before it's due. I certainly want to improve office hours, and hopefully things will get better as we get more used to what's going on, as some TAs who were previously not available due to various things going on related to everything become available, that this will go better. Now, I know some students have had, particular special difficulty, like computer availability issues, needing to suddenly move, and so on. There are case-by-case extensions for that. You can ask me privately. So, and on the issue of office hours, hopefully we're going to get more efficient, do things like, switch between students rather than waiting for you to do something so we can help more people at a time. There are some things you can do which will probably help us make them more efficient. In the office hour queue, we have a place for a description of what your problem is. And if these descriptions are specific enough, we might be able to group students with the same problem together and help them together, which is faster for a lot of people. If your description is like paging, we probably can't do that. Also, before you talk to a TA, it would be great if you have done some work to give the TA more information about your problem. So for example, figure out what test failed, try to narrow or simplify it. This will also apply to the FAT assignment. Figure out what your code is actually doing. It would be better if we don't have to tell you to add debug prints and get back to us, if you've already have those there, so we don't have to spend that time going back and forth. And try to use that earlier. Is there a way for the task description to not clear if someone submits their office hour request before you do? As you're typing it, that is probably a fixable thing. But involves me hacking on some JavaScript. Sorry about, I understand, I think I know why that's happening, because we trigger reloading a little too often when things change that we want to display on the page. If that's what you're asking about. Okay. So questions about these logistical issues. Okay, so that we have upcoming the FAT assignment checkpoint due a week from Friday. In this assignment, you're going to implement reading from a FAT file system. Your code probably will end up working on a real hard drive that is represented as a file, but we're going to have you read from a disk image, which is going to be a file on some other disk that has the contents of a hypothetical FAT formatted hard drive or solid state disk. And we're having you implement the actual file system. So we point to the specs from Microsoft that describe it. These specs describe a couple variations of FAT. You're implementing the FAT32 version only. You can also implement the others, but we don't care about that as far as testing. Some notes about things I did in lecture, which are a bit different. So in lecture, I implied that cluster number 0 is at the beginning of the disk. Cluster 1 is right after. The mapping is a little different. Please make sure you figure that out by reading the spec or asking us about it if you can't figure it out in the spec. Also, the end of file, in fact, I represent it as -1. The range of possible values for that is a little broader. So please pay attention to those two differences. So questions about the assignment generally. Questions, can we work in FAT on our own computer? Absolutely. There is no, this can be, yes, can be done without VM, including notably via SSH or NX into department machines. Or your own computer if you have an appropriate C or C++ compiler with a C++ compiler. Okay, other questions? Okay, so our main topic to start out with is going to be about hard drives and then solid state disks. And because I'm talking about both of these, some of you might say, why are we talking about hard drives? I don't use hard drives anymore. I use solid state disks. So there's two reasons for this. So currently, even though probably for many consumer applications, a solid state disk is a better choice, if you have a lot of storage, if you want to just store as many terabytes as possible and have it be accessible, hard drives are probably still the most cost-effective way of doing this. The other reason is that hard drives came first. And because they came first, there's a lot of design decisions we're going to see in both solid-state disk and file systems that are based around how hard drives work. So to understand those, it's useful to understand how hard drives work. Even if these design decisions perhaps may be not great choices for SSDs. That's what we're kind of stuck with. So here's a picture of a hard drive. And we're going to actually care about how some things work physically in a hard drive. So a hard drive here, this is a hard drive that you place inside like a desktop. And we can see here we have these platters, and there's actually a stack of these platters. You can't see it in this picture because they're hidden under here. And these platters, when the disk is operating, rotate and usually pretty fast, you know, something between 4,000 and 15,000 RPM, something like that. And as they rotate, there are these arms which move to lie over each of those platters. And you can see that there's a stack of these because there's a stack of platters here. And at the tip of these arms are what are known as heads. And these contain electronics to read and write magnetic signals that are stored on these platters. And these heads are very, very small. And the idea is that all these platters store data, and to get the data that we want, you have to move the arms over the part of the disk where that data is and wait for it to rotate and go over the head in order to get the data. And this is important because it affects how quickly you can actually read or write different parts of the disk, which means we're going to actually care about where things are physically stored a lot when we're talking about performance. So questions about this picture here about what these components are. So this physical layout is going to have some implications. And I'm going to give some names about how we're going to divide up the disk. So here are our platters represented sort of pictorially. And when the heads are in a particular position, they go over what we call a cylinder of the disk. And each of the platters has a track of that, what we call a track. And each of these tracks is going to be divided up into sectors. And as we learned, those sectors are the units that we can actually read from the disk. And this might be slightly simplified from what real modern hard drives do, but this is at least historically exactly how things worked. And when we think about how fast we can read data, we have some cost to consider about just getting these heads over the appropriate sector we want to read. So one issue is what we call seek time. And this is the time to move the heads to the appropriate cylinder. So seek time is going to be moving this head back and forth to the appropriate position over the disk. And an observation to make that's important is that if we have things that are in the same cylinder or in nearby cylinders, this time is going to be lower. So this 5 to 10 milliseconds I'm giving here, that's the speed if we have to go pretty far apart. And so 5 to 10 milliseconds is actually, it's pretty fast. So this, on our physical disk, that means this head is moving from like here to here in like 10 milliseconds. That is actually really fast in terms of like physical movement, but it's not fast from the perspective of our operating system, because remember, we've been talking about like time slices of like 1 millisecond or 5 milliseconds for a process, and it's going to take much longer than that to read data if we have to do this seeking. Another issue is what we call rotational latency. And that's the time for once we have the head somewhere here, how long it takes for the sector we care about to pass over it. So remember, the disk is rotating constantly, and this just depends on how fast the disk is rotating. So you can get faster hard drives that rotate faster and lower this time. And that's a real thing you can get, but there's some downsides. So one downside of these faster hard drives is they probably use more power because it just takes more power to rotate the platters faster. Another downside is that they're probably a lot noisier. But there's a range, that's why there's such a wide range of times here. And again, this is sort of the times assuming I have to go like most of the way around the disk. If it happens to be the case that the sector I want to read is right next to the head, then it's going to be faster for adjacent reads. The other consideration is once we get the head over the sector we care about, how fast do we actually get the data? And typically this ends up being 50 to 100 or more megabytes per second for actually doing the reads or writes once we pay the cost of getting the head to the right location on the disk. This top speed depends on how densely the data is stored and how fast the disk is rotating. Now, a key observation here is that if we want to avoid these penalties of seek time and rotational latency, we can do something about that in how we design our file system. That if we can arrange that we're accessing things that are adjacent on the disk, then it will be faster. And so that's going to be a major consideration we're going to see in real file systems, that we're going to try to access things that are next to each other physically on the disk. Now, historically, this was done very directly by operating systems. Operating systems would actually specify what cylinder to use. These days, it's less direct, but the same principles still apply. Question is, does it only take one pass under the head to read the whole sector? Yes. The disk is going to be designed so that we don't have to have the disk rotate multiple times to read each sector, or to read, a sequence of sectors that are next to each other. The other question is, how much data is stored in the sector? So these sectors are exactly the sectors we expose. So this is 512 or more bytes. So historically, it was always 512. These days, it's probably bigger, because 512 bytes is really small if we're thinking about like an 8-terabyte disk. Other questions? So thinking about this, if we think about how fast it is to read from the disk, you know, we have different components, and I talked about a bunch of them. So I talked about seek time and rotational latency and transfer time. We also have to worry about stuff that happens beforehand. So one issue is that sometimes when we're reading from the disk, we're going to have multiple reads to happen, and we're going to have to queue them up. And one concern is, like, how long do we have to wait until we get to the read we want? And another concern is that I admitted the overhead of we have to talk to the disk, talk to the device controller for the disk, and that's actually going to take some time. Now, something worth noting is that cylinders closer to the edge of the disk might be faster, because we'll have it moving faster under the head, because typically they spin at a constant speed. So like different parts of the disk have slightly different speeds. And this is actually a consideration about where we put the quote unquote beginning of the disk, that we want in the fastest part of the disk, because that's typically where the OS will start writing data. Now, I showed you this idea of cylinders, tracks, and sectors. And I said, historically, it was the case that the OS knew what cylinder, what track, and what head it was using. And this has been something that hard drives for a while now have stopped doing, basically. These days, all the OS knows is that they give a sector number. So the sectors are numbered, kind of like what I showed you when I was talking introducing FAT, that we're just numbering them basically from 0 to the maximum. But we still want to take advantage of things being close together on the disk. And we'll find out that there's reasons why there's these sector numbers, but there's going to be a pattern to how they're set. So the low sector numbers are going to be in the faster parts of the disk. And most importantly, adjacent sector numbers are going to be adjacent on the disk. And I say they're in the faster part of the disk, assuming there's a significant difference. But adjacent sector numbers are adjacent on the disk, meaning they're likely in the same cylinder or nearby cylinders. And this is something that the disk is going to make happen, but the actual location is going to be decided by the disk controller. And the reason hard drive manufacturers like doing this is that they can make their disks more reliable and more efficient by doing their own ideas about where they store the data on these platters rather than having the OS manage that directly. least that's what their thoughts are. But since we know adjacent sector numbers are adjacent on disk, a goal we're going to have later on as a file system designer is we would like to use adjacent sector numbers or nearby sector numbers for stuff that is accessed together. Now, we have these sector numbers, and I kind of alluded to how the OS talks to the disk before as it reads and writes whole sectors. So our disk controller is basically going to get a list of read and write requests. So we're going to like have use those that sort of magic memory idea to say, here's the sector numbers I want to write. Here's the location of the data, assuming DMA, direct memory access, that I want to read or write. And we send that to the disk. And typically a disk controller or an OS will have a queue of pending requests. So the OS will often send a whole list of sectors it wants to read or write all at once to the disk controller. And the disk controller will decide on what order to process them in with some restrictions. Usually it's important that the OS can say, hey, I want you to write this first just so I know what's written. But other than that, the disk controller has flexibility. And this is really useful because this means that what the disk controller can do is it can make sure it doesn't go like back and forth on the disk and waste time seeking, moving the heads around. It can do the most efficient thing with the list of requests it has. But of course, things will still be better if the sector numbers are near each other, so there's just less movement of the head to do. So questions about this idea of how the interface works and the concept that the disk controller is going to have this queue of work to do that it decides how to do this. Okay. So gave you an idea of how the disk works normally. Now, hard drives have some problems, and we'll see that this is a reason why we have these opaque sector numbers. So hard drives are unreliable. So in 2007, I'd like to get, maybe there's more recent data on this, but not many people do good studies, but Google published a study about the performance of all the hard drives they had in their data centers. And notably, Google used cheap disks. They weren't buying the expensive enterprise disks. They wanted to save money, and they did their own things to deal with this failing so they could handle failure. So they were buying cheap disks, and they were really using them a lot more than you might use your desktop hard drive. And they had an annualized failure rate, meaning percent chance each disk failures per year, depending on the model of disk in their environment, of between 1.7 and 8.6%. And that's kind of really scary. And by failure, I mean the disk needed to be replaced. This is not like it got, something weird happened once. This is, we need to replace this disk. It doesn't. Okay, so there's a high failure rate. And you might say, okay, well, it sounds like these hard drive manufacturers aren't really doing their job. But if the hard drive manufacturers weren't doing their job, the failure rate would be even higher. Of the working disks, 9% of them had what are called reallocated sectors. And this means that the hard drive controller had decided to change where the sectors are from its default idea in order to work around a failure. So when a hard drive, we have this physical disk, a common way it fails is we have our platter and some part of the platter will be, broken, physically broken. It won't store a magnetic signal anymore correctly for some reason. And that physically breaks a part of a sector or several sectors of a disk. And hard drives do a whole bunch of things to work around this. So one thing they do is they like store the data on the in the sectors in a redundant way. So if little pieces are broken, it's still okay. But even with that, it's still often the case that enough of the disk will break that some part of the disk is unusable. And rather than just saying, I don't work, modern hard drives do in their disk controllers what is called sector remapping. They detect that part of the physical disk has become bad, and they just change that sector of the disk to be located somewhere else on the disk. And this is a reason for those opaque sector numbers. Because the disk controller knows more about what parts of the disk are working correctly, it can make good decisions about how to avoid them, and that's not something the OS is really well equipped to do. So in order to do this, one of the things they need to do, and that they typically do, is that they'll actually, when you buy a hard drive, it will have a lower capacity than the amount it can physically store in order to have room for these moved, these remapped sectors, these sectors which now have a new location. And another challenge here is that the disk controller needs to maintain this mapping persistently, and that is in fact something they do maybe with a special part of the disk that stores the information, or maybe with some other type of storage. So questions about this sector remapping idea? I guess I should say. So that's about sectors. So this means that though typically nearby sector numbers are close on the disk, that's not actually a guarantee because this is going to happen and that's just normal operation. Now, I mentioned queuing requests. So this is like another reason to queue multiple requests. And in a typical system, we actually have just like we kind of talked about multiple buffers, we have multiple queues of reads or writes. So both the disk controller and the OS have a list of things they want to read or write to the disk. And at some point, we need to schedule these. So this is another scheduling problem of actually figuring out like how we can balance between having good seek time and making sure we handle the important requests in order to do that. And you can look up various ways that the disk controller typically might use to solve this problem of how do I actually efficiently handle all these queued requests. And something to note about queuing multiple requests is that this also gets rid of questions of like, what if I have two sectors next to each other? Can I really read them one after the other? The answer is yes, you queue both of the requests and you don't have to worry about how do I know, you know, when I'm, how do I make sure that I start the second read right after the first if they're JSON on the disk? The disk controller can do that for you, even though it can't like tell you, you know, very fast after it reads each thing. Okay. But something that we'll observe for file systems is that if you want to take advantage of this, you really want to request multiple things at a time, right? In order for this to be like actually useful. And this is a problem with FAT. So a reason it's a problem with FAT is that if we were thinking of like following the linked list, well, that's not actually a good idea to do that in the most obvious way where we read, you know, read the FAT, read a sector, read the FAT, read the next sector, and so on. what we actually want to do to implement FAT efficiently, which is awkward, is we'd want to like read the FAT to find the list of sectors to read, ask for all those sectors together. And maybe some other file system designs would be more amenable to that. And generally, you know, there are two things we can think of file systems being able to do. You know, so one of them is that we can like try to do reads together. So by like just like figuring out where is all the data asked for at once. We also saw that like read ahead kind of helps with this. Another thing we can do is do contiguous or at least nearby reads and writes to minimize that seek and time and rotational latency. And nearby means, you know, similar sector numbers, because as the file system, we don't actually know where the data is stored in the hard drive, but we have sector numbers as sort of a placeholder. And when we look at file systems later on, we're going to see that they're going to spend some effort to make both of these things easier, especially file systems that aren't FAT, so other designs that are more complicated, but you know, are going to be better in this respect. Okay, so that's about hard drives. So next I'm going to talk about something called solid-state disks. So solid-state disks, unlike hard drives, don't have moving parts. Instead, typically a solid-state disk has a controller with some memory. And this is what the, you know, this is. Here, this controller has some of its own memory and also has these, an array of these flash chips here. And these flash chips use an electrical mechanism, basically based on capacitors, to actually store bits. So flash has some advantages here. So one advantage is we don't have moving parts. And that's going to be a really big advantage. And that's, you know, the big reason why flash tends to perform better and be mostly more reliable than hard drives, because omitting moving parts really helps. And from a performance point of view, it also helps with that seek time and rotational latency, which were in the order of milliseconds. We're not going to have any of these order millisecond costs from the hardware in our flash. Now, the way these NAND flash chips work is that they're organized in a way which is rather different from how hard drives work. So each of those NAND flash chips can be read in these sector-like sizes, but typically they're bigger than a hard drive sector, at least historically, like 4 to 16 kilobytes. But unlike hard drives, in hard drives, we can send the head over any part of the disk and overwrite it. These NAND flash chips, they don't work that way. You can erase them, which resets their value, and then you can write once between erases. The writing process basically flips bits from 0 to 1, but not the other way around. Or alternately from 1 to 0, but not the other way around. But either way, you can write, but you can't undo the write without erasing a large block. And by a large block, they're organized into these erasure blocks, which are usually quite big. So like 256K or megabytes. So really big versus the 512 byte sectors we were talking about with hard drives. So one consideration we're going to have to think about is, you know, these erasure blocks are awfully inconvenient for file systems which are used to overwriting individual sectors or at least clusters, which are much smaller. And to make things worse, these erasure blocks, you can only erase them order tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of times. After that, the NAND, the flash chip starts failing, and that erasure block will stop working and start like getting wrong data and so on. And this is a problem for the sort of file system design we talk about. If you think about a file that's very frequently updated, you know, maybe some temporary file used by your web browser, every time we overwrite it, we were, you know, erasing the block that contained it and overwriting it, we could easily hit this tens of thousands of times issue. And worse than frequently accessed data that applications deal with, think about the file allocation table itself. You know, if we're overwriting that to every time we touch a file, that, you know, that's easily going to be way more than tens of thousands of times, you know, if we like do it every time we modify a file. So this is how the flash chips work. And when we talk about a solid state disk doesn't expose this interface. So a solid state disk is basically taking these flash chips, which have these weird constraints like erasure blocks and these pages that are bigger than sectors on a hard drive, and implementing the hard disk interface on top of them. And that's why in this picture here, I have a controller that includes a CPU and its own memory, because implementing this mapping from how these flash chips work to how hard drives work is not trivial. And quite often, this controller will be actually a pretty powerful processor, like something on the order of like a cheap smartphone. And when we're implementing this interface, we want to allow the ability to write a sector at a time, not an erasure block, and write arbitrary sectors, deal with the sectors being smaller, and we want to hide all of this, and we also want to use sector numbers, we want to have queues of reads and writes like hard drives do, we want to expose that same interface. And most importantly, we need to somehow hide that there are erasure blocks, that if we had the reliability of erasure blocks exposed, that would be really bad for things like a file allocation table where it keeps getting overwritten. We quickly reach the limit on the number of erasures. And also, if we just overwrote the whole erasure block every time we touched a part of it, that would be really slow. Like I'm writing one little thing, suddenly it's actually like 100 times as expensive because to implement that, I need to erase all the data around it and rewrite it. We don't want to actually do that. So questions about these goals before I show you what's this controller going to do in order to achieve this read and write a sector at a time, even though we can only overwrite in these big blocks. Okay, so the key idea that a SSD is going to use is something commonly known as a flash translation layer, where we'll take the sector numbers the OS uses and have a mapping to the actual physical locations on the flash. Now, we already did this with hard drives, but we only did that for things where we had a failure. Here, this mapping is going to be very actively maintained, and the sector numbers the OS is using might have pretty little relationship to the relative locations on the hard drive. But that's okay, because there's not much difference in the cost of accessing different net flash chips, because we don't have to physically move ahead or anything like that. So we're going to have this mapping. So let's say we have this mapping set up, and we're going to have our erasure blocks, which I'm going to draw with these pictures. So each of these pictures is an erasure block. So each of these, sorry, boxes is an erasure block. And these erasure blocks are divided up into the pages, which is the unit we can read from the flash chip itself. So here I'm saying this is pages 0 through 63, 64 to 127, and the erasure block is bigger, meaning that although we can read and write just page 0, if we want to erase, sorry, you can read and write once just page 0, if we want to overwrite page 0, we have to first erase this entire block. The question is, are these page numbers here? So these are the physical page numbers, and by physical, I mean, you know, within the SSD only. So this is not exposed to the OS. And these logical numbers are exposed to the OS. Does that answer your question? Okay. And you can see I have sort of three markings here. So we have active data in blue. So this is stuff where if the OS asks to read something, it will actually read that part of the flash. We have gray data, which is unused. So what happened here is that previously I put some data in this gray portion, but then the operating system asks to overwrite that data. But what the flash translation layer did is it didn't overwrite that data, it put it somewhere else instead. And also we have this yellow region. So this is stuff that we've erased and we haven't overwritten yet. And that means, for example, here, I've written to the first part of this erasure block, but I haven't, since I last erased it, written to the last part. So I can write some stuff here. And also this block is completely erased. It's ready for me to write to again. So when we do a read, reads are straightforward. The OS says, hey, I want to read sector 31. We look up, oh, that's at 74. We give it 74. There you go. If the OS, say, asks to write sector 32, we say, well, that was located here, but I'm not writing there. I'm going to write it just to my new, fresh location. I'm going to make up a new location for sector 32, update this table, and put the data the OS asked to write there. And as a side effect of that, we're going to mark this area here is going to be unused. So this seems straightforward, except for the issue of what happens when I keep writing stuff and I advance all the way to here. Like, that's a problem. And clearly I need to, like, if that happens, like, I'm out of luck. So I need some way of actually erasing more stuff. And what we're going to do in this implementation is we're going to say, okay, before I run out of space here, I'm going to erase, say, for example, there's multiple choices, I might erase this, but to erase that, I need to deal with all this active data. What do I do with that active data? Well, let's just copy it to where I'm writing. So we'll do what's called garbage collection to free up space. So the way that works here is I say, I want to erase this block, and it has all this data. So I relocate that data to where I'm writing, and I update this mapping over here to indicate what this data is, where this data is with the correction. And after I've done that, I can erase this whole block, and now I have more space to continue writing data. So something you might note is that while this works, this whole garbage collection process is pretty expensive, and that can make SSD performance kind of weird. Because if you have to wait for this to happen, it's going to be slow. If you don't, it's going to be fast. And I have a question on, is this what trim does? No, trim is something else. I think we'll talk about it briefly in a bit. This is something which happens just as part of imitating the hard drive interface. That because the OS is going to keep writing, we need to free up space to put what it's writing. Okay. So I gave you sort of the high-level view of this block remapping idea, you know, that we always write to a new location. We eventually free up space by doing garbage collection, by taking an erasure block, moving everything in it to a new location, then erasing it. So now we have free up the space that wasn't used in that erasure block. And this is actually pretty complicated to implement, which is why SSDs have a real processor. And if you think about doing this well, like in this picture, I erased the next block. Maybe that's not the best choice. So there's all sorts of interesting choices to make about where do we actually erase things and so on. And how do we do this without hurting the performance of normal reads and writes too much? That's our block remapping idea. So I have a question about this. So let's talk about this. So let's say we have a FAT-like file system SSD. I'm asking, we have these three different things that we're talking about. Which of them are likely to be stored in the same erasure block, assuming they're small enough to fit in one erasure block? And if this is likely, this is not actually a super clear answer. I'll give another 30 seconds or so. Okay, so we have absolutely no consensus. So I'll talk about each of these. So here I'm saying we have a log file all in one directory working continuously over months and assign a continuous range of cluster numbers. So first observation is these cluster numbers are OS numbers, not what the SSD uses. These are the SSD uses. So the cluster numbers mean that the numbers over here are similar, but not that the numbers over here are similar. So the cluster numbers being nearby doesn't tell us that it's actually stored together on the flash. And what I would think about is with the scheme I just told you about, whenever we write something, we put it in the next available location. And since this is written over months, like probably the next available location is not nearby for each of those writes because it's over such a long period of time. So I think this is not likely to be stored together, though maybe, so not stored together unless garbage collection tries to do that. So the way to do it. So way I could imagine it being stored together is, what if the garbage collection algorithm says, gosh, the OS wants to access these together, let me help you. But if that doesn't happen, I think these will be stored far apart. So then we have our next most popular answer, B. And note that these are written together. So even though they're assigned a variety of cluster numbers, even though there's a variety of values in the logical mapping, because they're written together, we're going to write them all to the same erasure block because we're writing them at similar times, and we're not going to have that many erasure blocks active for writing at a time. So these are likely to be in the same erasure block or a small number of them. Then we have all the entries in the fat if we only rewrite part of the fat when it's changed. So I think this is likely to be a part, again, except if the garbage collection tries to do it, because the fat's going to be big enough to span a bunch of sectors. Those could be put in different places. And each time we write for a particular file, that's going to relocate that part of the fat, but not the rest. So it'll probably end up a little scattered. So questions about sort of my conclusions about, you know, whether these things are likely to be in the same erasure block. Okay, so now that we know how SSDs works, let's talk a little about performance. So typically, reads and writes to SSDs are sub-millisecond. I'll get to your question in a bit. And whether it's contiguous mostly doesn't matter. It might matter if the SSD tries, that controller, when it sets up that block remapping, tries to make it matter. And generally, it can depend a lot on the controller. So what algorithm they use to make that mapping, to free up space for erasure blocks, you know, can dramatically affect the performance. Also, writing is often slower than reading because we have to do that fiddling with erasure blocks. And if the SSD is almost full, we might have to do a lot of really data around to free up space, including copying things that are already written in order to get, you know, there's a little bit of unused space in the erasure block. To free that up, we need to copy everything else in it. So that can end up being pretty expensive. So we can have these weird slowdowns when that happens. So does this mean that things we expect to be contiguous in memory might be scattered because of an SSD? So things we're storing on an SSD, yeah, might be scattered a bit around. But as I said, because it's not physical movement, like reading from different flash chips for the most part is not like that much more expensive than reading from one. That answer your question? Okay. So someone asked about trim. So I'll talk about trim. So trim is not an operation where the OS says, hey, I'm not using these sectors. And the advantage of this operation is that the SSD can just say, okay, you told me you're not using sector 31. Let me just cross this out and put not applicable. And it can do that rather than trying to copy the data for sector 31 somewhere else. And this can make things more efficient. And there's no real analog for this on a hard drive because we don't think of the hard drive as constantly moving our data around. So this is what the trim operation is. Does that answer your question about trim? Yeah, okay. So that's all I'm going to talk about storage. I have one very brief note about future storage technologies. So on the horizon for a while, there are new types of non-volatile memories. So typically, there's a bunch of technologies that are in this category of non-volatile memories. And the reason I'm calling them memories is that unlike SSDs or hard drives, their interface is kind of like DRAM, like normal memory, but they're persistent. They're non-volatile. They survive power loss. They keep the data around. And typically, their speed is in between normal memory and SSDs. And their capacity is either similar to DRAM or bigger. And it's kind of an unsolved question, what will file systems look like with this technology in mind? because all the sort of, a lot of the sort of things we're doing for a file system maybe make a sense if we can access each byte separately and don't have to work in clusters. And it's not clear. So this is something that might happen, you know, sometime in the next 5 to 10 years. This might actually start being a big thing. And I don't know what OSs should look like for this. Okay. So now that I've talked about how drives work, we're just talking about the XP6 file system. And this is XP6 file system is very similar to a modern file system on Linux or another Unix-like OS, and it does some things better than FAT. It does contiguous reads better, because we're going to store the information on a file in a way which is not as awkward as the file location table, and it handles crashes better. We're going to talk a lot about how we handle crashes. What if I lose power? What happens to my data? FAT really doesn't have a good answer for this. There's some terminology differences. XP6 and most Unix file systems, you know, this is just a vocab difference, call the units in which they divide the disk blocks instead of clusters. Non-vocab difference is that rather than having one big file allocation table, we're going to divide up the different types of information into different tables. So I'm going to show you what those tables look like, you know, first by showing you the overall layout of the disk. So in XP6, this is, we divide the disk up into blocks, which are numbered starting from 0. 0 is where the block containing sector 0. Like with FAT, a block might be multiple sectors. I think XP6 chooses to make it 1 to keep things simple. But in general, in Unix-like file systems, they might be multiple sectors. And there's what's known as a super block. This is the header. So the super block's the header. We allocate a whole block for it, even though it's smaller than that. It contains the size of the file system, the number of data blocks, number of inodes, and so on, which lets us know about the layout of the rest of the disk. So after the super block, we have a log, which we'll talk about when we talk about reliability. We have this inode array. So the inode, this is information about each file, followed by a free block map. The free block map tells us of these data blocks down here, which of them are used. And the data blocks are where we store actual file or directory data. So we have, you know, for reliability, this log. We have the actual file metadata. And here we have file data and directory entries. And here we have our blocks free information in the free block map rather than the FAT where we kind of combine a bunch of this information. So we have this inode, and this represents information about one file. And this includes some of the information that was put in the directory entry in FAT. We don't put the name here. We have, instead, the name is going to be stored in the directory entry, but all the other information about the file ends up being stored here. So we have the type of file. Is it a directory? Is it a regular file? We have a special type of file to represent devices. If it's a device, we have which device is it with a device numbers. We have this number of links. So it turns out, we probably won't go into this, that a file can have multiple directory entries that point to it. This keeps track of how many there are. We have its size. And we have where its data is. And this is the biggest difference we're going to see from FAT. That this is just an array of the locations of the file's data. And you might complain, that's a fixed-sized array. This seems like a problem. We'll go into why that's maybe less of a problem than you might think. But this means that if we want to find out where a file's data is, we read one inode, we get all the locations together. So that's kind of an advantage over FAT, where with that, you have to look at a bunch of places to figure out where the file's data is. Okay. You have this free block map. So this, rather than storing like that zero we saw in FAT, we have a bitmap with one bit per block. It's one if the block is used, available, zero if it's used. And this means that when we want to find a block to allocate, we scan through this. It's the same idea as finding a block in the FAT. You scan through it to find free things, but this is just stored more compactly, which is going to be an advantage for performance when we need to allocate something. You might want to ask, well, we have this array of data for files. How do we figure out where we put a file in that? XV6's solution is that they scan for a type field of zero. So zero equals unused in this type field, and they just scan the array for that. Some more other Unix file systems don't want to scan an array to find a free space, so they'll have a separate bitmap of free inodes. But both solutions work. One is might be faster at the cost of more bookkeeping. So that's layout of the disk. Now let's talk about directories. So we saw that a lot of the information we previously had in directory entries isn't going to be there. So all that's left to put in directory entries is this pointer to the inode array. So this is an index into that this section of the disk here, telling us where is the actual information about this file and the name of the file. And each of these directory entries is sometimes called a hard link. And the reason it's called that is that XV6 and other Unix file systems allow multiple hard links to the same file. So you can have multiple directory entries that point to the same actual file. And that's something that's possible because we store the information about the file in one place besides its name. So questions about directory entries and this general layout of the disk. Okay, so since XV6 is a particular implementation of the file system, we can talk for the first time about how does XV6 allocate inodes or data blocks? It finds the first one that's free. If you think about what we were just talking about with hard drive performance and running things close together, this is not good for that, but it's simple. So that's what they do. So we know how the blocks are allocated. We know that there's an array of them in the inode. You might ask, how big is that array? And the answer is that it's 12 entries. But fortunately, we don't use all the entries the same way. So the first 13 entries, the first 12 entries point directly to data for the file. So this is the first 12 times block size bytes of the file. But that actually would be pretty small. If the block size is 12 times 512 bytes, which is the block size XV6 uses by default, is 6 kilobytes. You'd be probably very disappointed if you could only store 6 kilobyte files. So XV6 has a different solution to deal with bigger files. And what they do is they say, okay, we'll have this last block, rather than pointing to data, it's going to be an indirect pointer. It's going to point to more block numbers. So this is one block of block numbers. And it turns out that, so this is 512 bytes and, or, you know, 2 bytes, 2 byte, I guess I have a problem with my, so this is two, so this here is going to be, really, okay. 2 bytes for block number, because block numbers are shorts, it turns out, times 256 blocks. So there's 256 pointers here to remaining data. So here we can have 256 times 512 bytes of data, and that's the next 256 times 512 bytes of the file. You might say, what if the file is bigger than that? Well, that's too bad. Don't use XP6. When we talk about real Unix file systems, we'll have a solution to make files bigger by doing more indirection. That's always our solution in computer science. So that's the solution. So if we add this up together, we can figure out what's the size of a file. We have those 12 direct pointers, 512 bytes. So that's where the first 6K are. We have one indirect pointer that points to a block of pointers that account in total for 128 kilobytes of data. And so this gives us this maximum file size. So questions about how I did this calculation? So this file size, this is fine for a sort of toy operating system like XP6, but if you think of like Linux, we'd really like something bigger. So I'm going to talk about how Linux is extended to file system, which uses a very similar design work. So here's the inode from Linux is extended to file system. You may notice there's some different fields, but it's basically the same idea. There's this mode, that's where the type information is. There's some extra information about like who owns the file, which we'll talk about later, some more information like modification times. But we have the same type of scheme for storing the data. We have an array of pointers. But if we just use the scheme XP6 used, even with a slightly bigger block size, we couldn't like store a movie. Right? That would just be too big. So what's our solution? Some of these pointers are going to use more indirection. So here's what the pointers look like in Linux's extended to file system. We have this array of block pointers, and the first 12, same number XP6 chose, point directly to data. So that's where our first 12 blocks are here. So this is the first 12 blocks. Then we have a pointer, two more block pointers. So that's where the next part of the file's data is. But sometimes that might not be good enough. So what we do is that we say, gosh, I only have a little bit of space left in this inode. What do I do with it? Well, I'm going to store a pointer to pointers. And this means that this next entry gives us much more space. And this is known as a double indirect. So we have our 12 indirect, and our double indirect pointer here that gives us much more space. And that might not be enough. So we make the next pointer, like if we need to go there, we want to make sure we hopefully are working out that we can still store this big file, so we have a triple indirect pointer. Okay, so questions about this overall layout. So you see we're using the same idea of having a block that doesn't store data, but stores pointers to other blocks. But we're just doing like more layers of them to support bigger and bigger files. And hopefully the triple is big enough that we're not going to care that it's limited. I don't see questions immediately, so let's do a little exercise on this. So my question is, how big can a file be? And we'll like be if we have 1K blocks and 4-byte block pointers. So note that this means the pointer to a block containing more direct block pointers, how many more? This is 1K divided by 4 bytes is 256 more. Question, would quad indirect be too much? I wouldn't be shocked if some file system has brought in direct blocks. As we'll learn probably next time, there's other solutions for really big files that might be better. So how do I do this calculation? So first I say the first 12K, that's 12 times 1K blocks, are stored here. Then here is the next 256 times 1K, 256 pointers times 1K blocks are here. Then we get the next 256 pointers to 256 things that are 1K blocks are stored here. So this is 256 pointers to 256 things. And for this, we get 256 times 256 times 256, same way. 256 pointers to 256 things that point to 256 things, each of which points to 1K of data. And we add these all up together, and we get our final result. And I think it actually does correspond to the majority result. So questions about how I figured that out? Question is, where are the inodes for files pointed out directly? So this is a misunderstanding. So this is inode for one file, contains this, and this is the data for one file. And all of this stuff is in the data blocks part of the disk. Does that answer your question? Okay, so I think that's all I have now. See you all next week.